tonight on Arena. Shadi Malone on playing the title character in Marion Quinn's film Twig, and Kathleen Jamie on outgoing National Poet of Scotland on her new collection, Cairn. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. At the beginning of this year, we spoke to some of the cast of the Gaiety Theatre's production of John B. Keane's Sive. Amongst them, Shadi Malone in the title role. We're thrilled to have Shadi back with us this evening, again to talk about a title role, this time the role of Twig in Marion Quinn's new film, a modern take on Antigone set in Dublin. In the film, Twig dreams of escape from a divided city. A gangland feud involving her brothers inevitably leads to tragedy, and Twig, seeking to do the right thing, stands up to King Leon and faces her fate. Delighted that Shadi joins us on the line this evening. She is quite the character, this Twig, isn't she, Shadi?
Absolutely. Well, firstly, thanks for having me. It's nice to talk to you again.
Yeah, you too.
She really is. She's some woman indeed.
Yeah, and I guess the basis, and we spoke to Marion Quinn about the film on the programme, because it opened the Dublin International Film Festival around the time, or in and around the time that you were doing Sive and the Gaiety, which must have been a very exciting time for you to have the two things happening in tandem. But this is based, the story of Twig, it's kind of a reimagining of the Antigone story into a contemporary Dublin setting, maybe a slightly future Dublin setting.
Yeah.
Just remind us of how that Antigone story is translated into the story that Twig tells in her film.
Yeah, well, I think Marion does a really, really clever job at sort of doing a nod to the original Greek story and then, you know, sort of that modern, slightly altered, it feels futuristic, but it's definitely today, but there's a heightenedness to it, which I think really complements the original piece, which is obviously a Greek tragedy, which is, you know, huge. It's the stakes are so high. So I think Marion does a brilliant job. There's little sort of Easter eggs and little nods to the original story, but then also at the same time, you really could be looking at a really new modern, you know, story too. So it's smart.
Yeah, so where we were dealing with King Creon and other Greek characters, where two brothers are divided essentially, and they both die, and the whole issue is one of them is allowed to be buried by King Creon because he was on the right side. The other one is not to be buried, but Antigone, or Twig in this case, the sister of Eamon and Eddie, the characters that they are in this modern retelling, she has to make that decision. Does she stand up to? As this case, in this case, it's King Leon, played by the wonderful Brian F. O'Byrne. Does she stand up to him, or does she just give in and not bother with the burying of her brother? Did you go back to the original sources in any way, Shadi, or was it just best to stick with the Dublin that Marion Quinn presented to you in the script?
Yeah, well, it was really a bit of both for me. I did the piece at school, actually. So it was always kind of there in my, you know, sort of in my ether in a way. I'd always kind of remembered it really well from school. So I definitely, when the audition came through, I did go back to that text. But then, you know, it gets to a point where you have to just service sort of what is in front of you as well in the conversations that we had. So there was definitely an element of it where I wanted to revisit it, but then, you know, it gets to a point where you have to just focus on the text in front of you, I think.
You played that character of Antigone in the Sophocles play. Was that?
No, I actually played, Izzy is me in school. So I was the sister.
All right.
So, yeah, it was funny to step into Antigone Twig's boots for obviously this production then.
That's interesting, because Izzy in this production is played by Galia Conroy, and another character that really stood out for me here was Jade Jordan playing the character of Irene. They are
they're both amazing, but
quite a trio, the three of you together in this.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, in real life too, we're so lucky that we got to work together, and you know, considering the play is, you know, sad, you know, it's not the play, the film is, it's a sad film and play. and you know, it's heavy hitting and the scenes are hard, but we just had such a great time together, which, you know, is testament to, I think, the environment that Marion creates on set, but then also just out of that work environment, we just really clicked, which, you know, is helpful for that chemistry.
Yeah, and the casting here by Louise Kiley, very interesting as well, given that yourself and Galia and Irene come from a Black Irish background. Was that discussed in any way, or how did that feed into the film as it was realised?
Yeah, so originally there was, you know, there was in the breakdown, there was nothing about how the character looked. And I think I kind of came around and then I got cast, and through that it was a ripple on effect. Then, you know, Paulie and Eddie are two Black mixed race characters, and then we have Izzy as a Black mixed race character too. So it was, you know, that was really empowering, the fact that that one casting choice sort of kind of created a ripple on effect. And usually with a film, then, you know, when you have Black leads and a Black family at the forefront, you don't usually get maybe a friend or the other kind of characters, the supporting characters on as a person of colour too. So it was really exciting that Jade got that role, because, you know, she absolutely deserved it. She's a phenomenal actress. So it just, yeah, it felt like a really exciting thing to be a part of. And then as we went on, we had loads of conversations, and, you know, that was really special for a lot of us, because majority we've not been in a room with, you know, that many people that look like us. So it was really, really exciting.
Let's have a listen to a clip that features yourself, obviously, as Twig Shadé, and Galia Conroy as Izzy, the character that you played at school, the sister. This is the sister. Now, the brother is dead, and King Leon is not a happy bunny. Izzy says that, look, can you not just be quiet for once, please, Twig, and keep your counsel and do what we're told?
What are we going to do?
We're not going to do anything.
You wouldn't help your brother?
Who killed his own brother? We can't.
Why not?
What are we gonna do? Two girls against Leon and his men. Leon's king now. All we can do is keep our heads down.
That's all right. I'll do what needs doing. I don't want or need you.
I don't know if you're thick or just pig-headed. You heard him in this very house say what you'll do.
I'll not let Leon dictate to me what I can do with my own flesh and blood. There's Leon's law and God's law.
Well, I'm going by Leon's law, so, because I'm in the land of the living.
And there we have Galia Conroy and Shadé Malone in Marion Quinn's film Twig. Galia playing the character of Izzy, and Shadé Malone, who's with me on the programme this evening, playing the character of Twig. Izzy asks at one point in the middle of all of that, are you thick or just stubborn or whatever? I'm not quite sure what
it's so well. Yeah.
But it struck me that, you know, what Marion did in the script, and yet further down in there, there's talk about God's law and the law of the living, or Leon, King Leon's law. That mix of the kind of the ancient and the contemporary, it's phenomenal what Marion managed to do with that. How did that work for you as an actor? You know, did you think, are you just thinking purely in contemporary terms?
I mean, it's so smart what Marion did to be able to, I think it's really seamless, that kind of dialogue, because it does go from, you know, extremely modern language, and then you do have that heightened sort of essence as well to it. But I think, I mean, the piece, although it is modern, it kind of felt like we were creating our own world, you know, as well. So it didn't feel, because that was sort of the language that we had been using from the start, it didn't feel off. It kind of felt like it really worked well together in harmony, because it was the kind of world that we had, you know, created.
Yeah, and some of that language, which, yes, it has that ancient feel to it, but it fits perfectly in the contemporary setting, and even has a vernacular feel to it in that respect. I have to say, to the three women, yourself, Galia, and Jade, as Irene, Twig, and Izzy, it's the women and other characters in here as well. Jane Stanley Brennan's character, for example, as the wife of King Creon. It's the women who carry the can a lot in these plays. And it's certainly the case in this film.
Well, absolutely. And I think it's so true to life when it comes to sort of, you know, war and pain in that way. It is the women that through history are the ones to kind of, you know, sweep the pieces up at the end. And I think, again, Marion does such a good job at having these really strong key women, you know, at the heart of it.
It is very strong in that respect. Let's talk a little bit about Sive and your experience at the Gaiety Theatre earlier this year. I suppose your ethnicity in something like even a modern version of a Greek play is one thing. How did ethnicity play into your portrayal of Sive? You know, this canon of Irish literature, and you were playing that character as yourself and physically as you look. Did that feed in any way into the production and into the playing of it as it played in the Gaiety for you?
I think, you know, funnily enough, as when we were talking about it, it added a really interesting take without really changing much, which was interesting. I think that was kind of the idea in the first place, that if we, you know, we do this and we replace kind of what we know Sive to look like with a mixed race woman in the 1950s, what will that be? And I think there are just naturally things that stick out more. So, you know, there was a part in it where Mina, the anti character, was brushing my hair, and you know, that's actually quite a loaded thing, you know, to see. So it's kind of like imagery and different words. You just naturally put a different kind of take and spin on it when a different casting choice has been made. I think actually only really added to the heat of the kind of melting pot. I think it really worked.
Yeah, I believe your grandmother came to see it more than once.
Yeah, she brought everybody she knows. John B. Keane is one of her favourite writers. So honestly, this was just the most exciting thing ever for her. Like, it was, you know, she was so excited that I got this role, and it was just so amazing for her, for, you know, to see me up there. And she's an amazing woman, and brought all her friends, and it was great.
Yeah, I'd say you were the star every night coming out. You were royalty coming out from backstage. Now, your own background, you've roots in Greater Manchester, in Dublin, in Leeds and in Barbados. How do you think that has influenced the kind of acting choices you've made, Shadi?
I think it's kind of just been something, it's been a ripple-on effect, really. I grew up for a big part of my life in Dublin, in Tallaght. So kind of going from there, I moved back to the north, trying to keep a long story short. and I ended up going to drama school in Liverpool, Paul McCartney School, LIPA, and got an amazing agent. And through that, I ended up doing a play. And it was an Irish production, but set in an Irish production in London. And I think for me, that's where the kind of gates opened for the Irish industry. And I ended up kind of working more and more in Dublin and Belfast, which I love. So it's sort of, it's been a kind of piece thing, why I've kind of ended up doing a lot of Irish work, which, like I said, I love. But I think, you kind of just go with, you know, what comes in the inbox from the agent and stuff. And I love doing different accents. And I think I end all my friends, when I came back from doing Sive, they were just like, your accent's changed again, you know, which is funny. But I love, because, you know, it's a part of me and it's my roots at the end of the day.
Exactly. And I guess there are two things in that regard. I suppose when you're young and growing up and moving from place to place like that, often what you're trying to do is not sound any different from anybody else in the schoolyard with you. So you learned how to do new accents very quickly, I'm guessing.
I think so. I think, like, looking back and reflecting on that, that must be the case. I think at the time I was just trying to fit in wherever I went, and, like, you know, everyone would just be like, you sound different. So you're constantly trying to you know, blend in. And then I think you just end up doing that. And I think as an actor as well, you're like empathetic. You want to kind of always be on the same level as someone, you know, when you're having a conversation. So I always end up sort of copying the people I'm talking to as well, but it's only a positive when it comes to acting because it helps, you know, being able to.
And the other thing that struck me is that people have said, did she say she moved north? And of course, you mean the north of England. There is a kind
the
of,
north yeah, yes, yeah.
There is a kind of affiliation, I think we could say, possibly more of an affiliation between the north of England and Ireland than between the north of England and the south of England. Do you feel that affinity across your Irishness?
Oh, absolutely. I think my granddad was a Scouser, and I think another thing into the melting pot of me. But we always say that, you know, there's such similarities between like Dublin folk and Scousers. It's so intertwined, you know, and just I think a lot of, you know, my family, when they come over, when we go to Manchester and they go to Leeds, it's very similar people.
You mentioned the Liverpool Institute for Performing Arts, LIPA, which, of course, Paul McCartney involved with that school. Did you meet him? Do you get to meet him during your time there?
Yeah, you do. You meet him at your graduation. You get a photo, which was so exciting because I love Paul McCartney. And, you know, he does a lot for the school. His sort of ethos is all the way through the school. And he's just an incredible man.
Well, we've talked about your mum and your dad. We've talked about your granny and your granddad and your dad, I think, in there as well. We better mention your mother, who is a dancer. How much of a help was that for you? You know, sometimes if you see something as a possibility, so you saw your mother presumably working in the arts.
Yeah.
To what extent did that make it for you? That's something I can do too.
It's so funny. I think it was just something that was always there. So it was never really a thought. My mum is an amazing dancer, and as the years have gone on and she started to help me with, you know, self-tapes and auditions and stuff, she's an amazing actor as well. Like, I'm always like, you really need to act. It's never too late, honestly. She's incredible. But I just think it was always there, and I was so lucky she never pushed. I worked from a young age. I got my first job at 14, and it just really felt like such a natural progression. And again, like, I was lucky that she never... It was never a pushy thing. It was always done.
And can you can you tell me much about any upcoming work or anything that's in the offing for us, for you, Shadi?
I can't, unfortunately, but I'm just really enjoying time with family and friends and having that moment, because you don't know when you're going to be gone again and for how long. So I think it's important to enjoy the time when you can, you know.
Well, I've no doubt that something will come your way soon, and certainly the opening of Twig in cinemas will help that along the way, I have no doubt. Congratulations on the performance in Twig, and lovely to speak with you again, Shadi.
Thank you so much.
And that's Shadi Malone, a title character in Twig, the Marion Quinn film, which is in cinemas from this Friday. A competition for you now. Tonight we are offering one listener a pair of tickets to Circle Mirror Transformation by Annie Baker, currently playing at the Gate Theatre in Dublin, and the tickets are for Thursday the 27th of June. This play tells the story of five people taking part in a drama class in a small town community centre in Vermont. It's a meditation on theatre and the passing of time. Full details of the production on gatetheatre.ie. Along with the tickets to the play, our winner will enjoy a luxurious overnight stay at the Croke Park, part of the Doyle Hotel Collection, the Doyle Collection Hotel Group, and your stay includes breakfast the following morning. To be in with the chance of winning the prize, all you have to do is answer the following question. Niamh Cusack plays Marty in Circle Mirror Transformation, but which famous actor was Niamh's father? The hint is in the name. Text the answer with your own name to 51551. We will announce the winner before the end of tonight's programme. The Dublin International Organ and Choral Festival, Pipeworks, returns this week with a masterclass, organ recital and concert from Daniel Molt scheduled throughout the festival. Daniel is a renowned organist, recording artist and educator. And through his many TV series, he has played most of the great organs around the world. For the opening concert on Wednesday the 19th of June, the opening concert of Pipeworks, that is, there will be a celebration of the work of Charles Villiers Stanford, marking the 100th anniversary of his death with a special performance of stabbed matter. But also on the night, Daniel will perform works of the late organist and post-romantic composer Percy Whitlock. Among those pieces is this wonderful fanfare. Bit of the fanfare composition of Percy Whitlock, performed by Daniel Moat, who is sitting across the desk from me right now. I was saying as we were listening to that, I think Percy Whitlock is probably a much quieter man, or was a much quieter man, than that particular piece suggests, Daniel.
I think that's spot on. I suspect that he would like to stay at home with a cup of tea and by the fire. Mm. And he was organist for a long time at the Pavilion in Bournemouth on the south coast of England. Mm. So he was very used to sort of writing tunes and accessible music for the sort of audiences of Bournemouth, Southampton.
I was
going to
say, so when you say the Pavilion of Bournemouth, do you mean like a kind of a holiday organist?
Yeah.
So he wasn't playing church music.
No, absolutely not. He was very versatile. He was trained in that sort of cinema organist tradition, well as the classical tradition. And he wrote what is sometimes referred to as light music, but he wrote serious music. He had a church job on Sunday. So he was a very versatile figure and a real sort of master at what he's done. And sadly, he died before his time. He was 39, 40. He had suffered ill health when he passed away. So I think that's why he's rather forgotten. And then post-war sort of taste changed, he was overlooked. And in the last sort of 20 years or so, he's really come to preeminence again, which is fantastic.
Have you ever played the cinema-style organ yourself coming up
I did once, there's one in the northwest of England at Stockport. I was allowed a quick go on it. It's a very, very different technique from playing the church organ. But a lot of the cinema organists were classically trained. Mm. Like famously at Blackpool Tower, and it is a famous English venue with an organ that accompanies ballroom music. The organists there were often classically trained and played in church.
What makes it so different, I mean, in layman's terms, between the, you know, the church organ and that kind of cinema organ? I just love, the, you know, you often see it in films where literally the organ rises up out
on a
of
lift.
The ground.
Yes. Sometimes the lifts get stuck, apparently, as well, which not much fun if you're claustrophobic. The difference, I think, is it's more of a musical style. So it's quite a different sort of style of playing as well. Also, how you operate the instruments is different. It's different rules. So it does take quite a bit of adjustments, I'm told.
Yeah, because it strikes me that fanfare that we just heard, it probably is something a little bit closer to that cinematic style, isn't it?
I think, exactly. It sits somewhere sort of in the gaps, doesn't it? Yes, yeah.
So Whitlock himself, what period are we talking? Did you say around in between the wars?
Between the wars, absolutely. And he died in 1943, I think, thereabouts. So when he wrote this masterpiece, this organ symphony, which was in a garden shed in the middle of England for a long, long time, there's another story. And it's recently been resurrected by David Lee at Pipeworks. When he wrote that, it was 1937. So he obviously thought this was his masterwork. He would be hoping for lots of performances. 2 years later, of course, all concert life in Europe collapsed. Yeah. And so a lot of music got forgotten. And poor Percy, I think, was, you know, symptomatic of that.
Yeah. And I'll come back to that symphony, because that you are going to play that piece, and in fact will be the Irish premiere of it. But I want to get maybe more of a sense of the type of music that perhaps Percy Whitlock was better known for. He's close to, could we say, I suppose, the pastoral side of Vaughan Williams, that kind of area.
Spot on, Sean. Yeah, he was he studied with Vaughan Williams at the Royal College of Music. He was his composition teacher, in fact. So you've got this sort of rather nostalgic yearning for past age, that, as you say, that pastoral feeling, bits of folk music in the mix as well, and always want to write a tune, Whitlock as well. Very memorable tunes.
Yeah, and we have a folk tune of his here. This is, I think, this folk tune miniature, is this part of a set of folk tunes?
That's right. It's part of a set of five pieces, and it's probably his most famous piece. It's
very are you playing this? Will you be playing these?
I'm not, I'm afraid. No,
but you are playing
this. But this is on YouTube.
this is your recording of it.
It is, I'm afraid. Yeah,
well, let's have a listen to the pastor, the gentler side of Percy Whitlock. There we have a folk tune miniature by Percy Whitlock, the organist and the composer whose music will feature as part of this year's Pipeworks Festival with Daniel Molt, who's with me in studio this evening. And I was saying, Daniel, just before I faded it there, where the big chords come in, it really does sound like Vaughan Williams.
Absolutely.
Although there is a sacred side to that music as well.
Yes.
It's not just pastoral folk music.
I agree entirely. I think the fascinating thing with Whitlock is he's very hard to pigeonhole. And one thing, learning the symphony, which has been an absolute joy, I have to say, I've enjoyed every minute of it, is you feel you're in a different musical room, you know, every few phrases. Sometimes you're at the cinema, so it's quite filmic, some of it. Mm. Sometimes you're at the ballroom, you can hear him playing for the tea dancers in Bournemouth. Other times you're in church. And he's a very fascinating composer. And this makes it sound like it's a bit of a dog's breakfast, but he's so skillful that it's all sort of wrapped together really beautifully, you know. So it doesn't.
I guess symphony for organs are not, well, certainly in this particular period of musical history, are not that common.
That is absolutely the case. And I think what sparked it, he was reading in a TV list magazine, a famous English musician saying, oh, there aren't many pieces for organ and orchestra. And Whitlock said to himself, well, there aren't, I better write one. And it's a big orchestra. And, you know, it's not like an organ concerto where the organ dominates and the orchestra like gets a bit of a look in as and when. Hmm. This really is a piece that integrates the two. So the organ is part of the story. And it's really thrilling. I mean, the climax is, if you think, you know, hairs on the back of a neck when you're listening to a big orchestra. Hmm. And then you've got the full charge of a massive instrument like the organ as well. It's really cataclysmically powerful in the big moments.
Yeah, I think we have a snippet, because this hasn't been recorded commercially yet at all.
No.
But we have a little snippet of a recording that was made, I think, is it with the Birmingham Symphony Orchestra?
One of the BBC ones, I think. It was a radio broadcast back in 1989, so.
All right, yeah, okay. So let's have it. And this is from the Toccata and Fugue movement, which is the final movement of
the work.
That's right, yes. Which I guess is really at the climax of the work itself.
Absolutely, yeah.
Right,
yeah.
Well, let's have a listen to that snippet. And there we go, part of the, just a little snippet from the Symphony for Organ and Orchestra of Percy Whitlock, a work that will be in, played in full by Daniel Moat as part of the Pipeworks, upcoming Pipeworks Festival, Festival of Organ Music and Choral Music in, indeed. And this will be the Irish premiere of,
the
of this
Irish
work.
Premiere. And in fact, it's not had many performances at all. David, the artistic director and conductor, and I, we reckon there's probably been only four or five public performances ever. So, yeah. so this is a real landmark. So it's thrilling that, you know, the RTE Concert Orchestra are doing this. I think that's a really powerful thing. And I just hope it gets the piece recognised. Because Whitlock, the organ music, is starting to become well known in Germany. It's a very big following in Germany. Yeah. And I think, you know, his hour's coming. I think composers have their hour. And I think this is Whitlock's hour. I do hope so.
And you were saying that part of the reason, I mean, Whitlock's early death is probably part of the reason that the music faded in some ways into obscurity.
Yes.
This particular score, a garden shed, did you say?
Yes. So his widow, bless her, I think, lovely lady, but by all accounts, perhaps not great at promotion, which nowadays is so critical to get composers recognised. And I think she kept some of his scores when she passed away 30 years ago. An enthusiast of Whitlock's music took them to his garden shed in Rutland, in England. Kept them, luckily, in very good condition. I unearthed these in another basement of a library in Birmingham. It's a real tale. So we've these same parts, which have been salvaged in very good nick, are the ones that the RTE Orchestra will be using.
Now,
so
when you say I unearthed these in the basement of...
Not personally, but as a librarian friend, yeah. We knew they were staying there, but they'd not even been properly catalogued. It just said Percy Whitlock Symphony. You know, it didn't have all the details of the parts and scores like, you know, most professional libraries have. So even catalogueing has had to sort of start again, as it were. So it really is.
And your reaction then when you thought, yes, we have it. We have the Whitlock Symphony. We have the parts for the orchestra. What was that moment like for you?
It was absolutely thrilling. Not for me or my ego, but just because, you know, you feel in a small way this great music can be told again, can be heard again by new audiences. And that's a very humbling feeling.
Now, as you said, the RTE Concert Orchestra are part of that performance, and you will be performing it in the Church of the Immaculate Conception. Most people here will refer to it as Adam and Eve's.
That's right, yeah.
Are you familiar with the organ in that church?
Just before I came here, Sean, I had 2 hours practice, and it's magnificent. So I'm looking forward to getting its acquaintance further. Lovely acoustic, thrilling organ, a real gem.
Yeah, and I guess that is, I mean, I suppose it's the organist's trade for sure, because, you know, you don't carry one around with you.
Sadly not.
you have to go to the various churches that they're in.
Yeah.
But I guess it's a double thing. It's, first of all, the instrument itself, but its setting within the church must be hugely important as well.
I agree entirely. It's. I mean, obviously the acoustics, how it sounds in the room, how clear it is, whether it's on the main axis so that the sound projects. Also, I think just the atmosphere of the room, isn't it? There's, you know, a beautiful church like Adam and Eve's. You know, just the inspiration of the architecture gives another dimension when you're there listening to the music.
And in terms of balance with orchestra, I was asking you, I suppose, when we talk about an organ symphony, the one with which most people will be familiar is Camille Saint-Saëns' Organ Symphony. Is it number 3, I think?
That's
you
right,
said
yes,
it,
yeah, yes.
And in fact, they'll know it because it was the music that was used in the film Babe all those years ago. And I think it became hugely popular,
that's right, yes,
the piece,
yeah.
After that. That balance between organ and orchestra, I mean, we got a sense of how they can really add together to make a huge sound. How difficult is that for you as the organist? I mean, you have all these pipes all around you. Are you hearing that? Can you hear the orchestra? How do you strike that balance?
It varies depending on the room. Quite often you're reliant on the conductor, actually. So the conductor will say, too much there, too little there, and then you gauge it as you go along and you make adjustments with the stops that you're using. But, you know, it's not a precise science, but that's one of the things that takes a lot of rehearsal time. And there's a little bit of sixth sense involved, and you just pray that you've sort of got it right so you're not wasting too much of your orchestral colleagues' time.
Yeah. And David Lee will be the conductor on the night as well. I see the festival chorus are part of that. Is that for the Stabat Mater?
That's right, for the wonderful Stabat Mater. Super, which has a small organ part, which I'm not playing, but it's primarily a choral and orchestral piece. And I gather, I don't know it. It's, but again, something else that's undeservedly been overlooked. Mm. Stamford, magnificent composer with his centenary of his death this year. Yeah.
And finally, let me give you two questions to finish. finish up. You're doing a masterclass. Where will you be giving that masterclass? And are we talking about people who are at a serious level of organ playing who will be playing for you there?
That's right. Yes, we're people who've been playing for some time. Quite a lot of younger people, which is always fantastic. Mm. It's always thrilling to work with the next generation and help in a small way there. That's at St. Philip's Milltown on Thursday at 3 o'clock. As far as I'm aware, it's a public event, so people can come along and watch. And if they're three, then...
Yeah. Now, you have played Bach, you have played Handel, you have played Elgar, you've probably played the Saint-Saëns, I'm sure, yes, somewhere along the line as well. Where does the Whitlock Symphony in G minor sit for you in that great body or a pantheon of works?
What an interesting question. I think I've been, in all honesty, more excited learning this than anything in recent years, because I just think it's such a brilliant discovery. You just feel humbled to be part of it. And I would just hope, you know, that in 20, 30 years, it's just a standard part of the repertoire. Because it really deserves it. It really does. Yeah.
Well, I must say, Daniel, your enthusiasm the last time you were in was enormous.
Bless it.
And you have outdone it this time.
Thank you, Sean. It's been a pleasure. Yeah.
Maybe the Whitlock Symphony has...
I think this is it. It's given me a spring in my step.
Up the ante for you. And Percy Whitlock's Symphony for Organ and Orchestra will be presented as part of the Pipeworks Festival opening concert on Wednesday the 19th of June. And that, as I said, is in the Church of the Immaculate Conception in Dublin 8, Adam and Eve's to you and I in the Liberties. There will also be a special performance of Charles Villiers Stanford's Stabat Mater on the night. And the Pipeworks International Organ and Choral Festival runs from June the 19th through until June the 23rd. You can find out full details on pipeworks.ie. Now, we've just been talking about organ symphonies with David Moult. Now we talk about sad symphonies. Latest album from Kate Nash is 9 sad symphonies. It'll be out this Friday, in fact. And from that particular album of the London and LA-based Brit Award-winning singer, songwriter and activist, we will listen to a song called My Bile.
So fast, you know I ride it recklessly. I'm speeding blind round corners, hoping that the driver sees me. Need to test the dealer, dealing cars, but do they listen? For all my lies and mistakes, wasted time, am I forgiven? The priest, he told me life isn't fair, then taught me a lesson. And the boy who whipped me up by stricken me is just conditioned.
Yes, that song is the little patience I have left to give to the industry, the media, the way people talk to other human beings, me as a woman in the industry, all the things people say about you online, explains Kate Nash. I'm done. I don't have anything left to give to that. I've proved who I am with actions, which is more important. I just have bile left. Gives you a great song. It does it. Her Bile. My Bile, the title of the song from Kate Nash's latest album, 9 Sad Symphonies, out this Friday, and one of 3 that we will be reviewing on Friday night's programme. Kathleen Jamie is the outgoing National Poet of Scotland, or Marcar, as it is in Scots Gaelic. Her work is deeply connected with nature and the Scottish landscape, and her new book is a collection of personal notes prose poems, micro essays and fragments. The idea is that they are arranged here like the stones of a cairn. As she writes in the title poem to the collection, "Sure, we shelter you, we rough old assemblages, decades of stone heaped on stone, hawks perch, lovers tryst, flowers in a jam jar, add one or scatter us. We are more than the sum of our parts." That is the title poem, Cairn, of Kathleen Jemmy's new collection. And I'm delighted that Kathleen joins us on the phone this evening. And I also love the fact, Kathleen, that that poem is a shape poem. The word "sure" up on that very top line. And then as those lines get slightly longer on the way down, shaped like a triangle, shaped like a cairn itself. Most people in this country would be, I suppose, one of the most famous cairns would be Queen Maeve's, the tombed Queen Maeve on the top of Knocknarea in County Sligo. Are there cairns around you? Were there cairns that were part of the inspiration into this particular piece?
Oh, good heavens, yes. I'm a keen hill walker, so almost every day I'm encountering cairns on the summits of hills or just wayside cairns. Yeah, we can't move for them.
And are you a bringer of stones up to these cairns? Are you a believer in that when you hill walk?
No, I don't do it, but obviously many people have, because there's some quite large structures. But if you're ever lost, you know, and this happens on the hills, it's very reassuring to find the cairn and think, oh, right, now I know where I am.
Ah, right.
So I don't do it myself, but have been grateful to other people for doing it.
Yes, because it kind of helps you find your way. Again, I suppose it is such an evocative image in many ways. Even the image of the cairn itself, this great mound of stones on the top of a mountain, it must speak to you to your poet's mind as much as anything else.
Well, this book was almost complete before the idea of the cairn or the image of the cairn came to me, and because I didn't know what I had, I just had a pile of bits of work, and then, oh, what is a cairn but a pile of stones, and shaping them into that structure, or thinking of them all in that structure, that made the book, you know. But I didn't set out with that intention, it just happened almost when the book was done.
Yes, you knew it after the event, rather than, you know, it wasn't a design that you had drawn at the beginning to write, I'll make a cairn of poems. It ended up being that.
I can't think like that.
Yeah, but you do speak in the prologue to the book. You speak about an event of 30 years ago. I must say, it sounds so romantic the way you describe it in that opening prologue in Stromness, wasn't it? A very stormy night. Maybe describe to us what happened then and how that has kind of fed into and led into this particular collection.
The prologue to the book describes an event 30 years ago, as you say, a very stormy night, and I went out to like a romantic fool to feel the storm, and it seemed to me in my youth that the wind and the rain and the lighthouses and weather flashing were all making some sort of great signal, and I tried to write a poem about it, you know, same 30 years ago, and the poem didn't work, it wasn't very good, but I made that same walk again just last year. And I was just musing on the difference 30 years have made in the way we appreciate or our attitudes toward the wind and the weather and the natural world, you know, has had to change across that time. And yes, one can't any longer be taken up with great romantic notions, I don't think, because not all is well out there.
Do you mind sharing, you do it within the collection anyway, do you mind sharing that short poem, or certainly a section of that short poem that you give to us in the prologue, and how, because there's a particular line in it that I think means something very different today than it did to you 30 years ago.
Oh no, this is a worst nightmare, having to recite the poem you reproduced because it was bad, you know. And it was the way that the lighthouses were flashing. They seemed to have a sort of morse, you know. And it was like they were saying, "Never ever harm this. You never could."
Yeah, it's that line, "Never ever harm this. You never could." I think that has become, in other words, you're never going to be able to harm this landscape. You're never able to destroy this landscape or have any effect on it. You just wouldn't have the ability. How has your attitude to the landscape possibly and to nature changed then in the intervening period?
I don't think one can have that attitude any longer. I feel almost nostalgic for it now. That was the early 1990s, and that must have been like the before times, or the very last days when you could think the natural world is bigger than we are, and whatever mess we make, the natural world will restore itself and it will survive and everything will be okay. You know, I don't think we can't take that attitude any longer. Certainly anybody born since then would think we're fools for having that attitude.
Yeah, and as national poet or marker, which I had to go looking this up actually for my own delectation, the word in the Irish, in Gaeilge that we would speak is marcor, which literally means a marker, which is a very interesting word in terms of a national poet. That's what you had to do, I guess. That's what the role was, marking occasions, marking things that happened, marking things that had to be marked and taken note of. How much of a guideline was that to you in that role as National Poet of Scotland?
Well, in Scots, the word is not Gaelic, but Scots. It means maker, simply means maker. But I don't like that Gaelic marker. Yes, that works as well. Part of my job was to mark great occasions, and you never knew what was going to turn up, just events, dear boy. So the great occasions that have occurred during my tenure as marker, I felt obliged, that's not quite the word, I felt I must rise to the occasion and produce a poem to speak to them. So we had all sorts of things.
Yes, yeah, you had, I mean, you wrote poems about COP26, you wrote about the Ukraine invasion, and indeed you wrote about Queen Elizabeth II's death. You're not a royalist. How difficult a poem, or how difficult a thing was that to make a poem about?
Well, I'm not a royalist, but for the first, obviously the Queen died in Scotland, so it was, you know, for the first 24 hours I thought, dignified silence. And then I thought, no, come on, Kathleen, you're the national poet, and this is a national event in Scotland, par excellence, you know. And I also knew that for the time that the Queen's body lay in Scotland, you would hear Scottish voices. But the minute it left Scotland on its journey to London, you would hear no more Scottish voices. So I thought, you know, I've got to make some gesture here. Now, that's exactly what happened, of course. You know, so I did go to the landscape, which is always, you know, ever giving, and thought about the landscapes around Balmoral, where the Queen died and where she possibly went to die. And yeah, just set myself to it.
And in terms of your conclusion at the end of the writing of that poem, had you hopes that it might lead to a new dispensation in terms of royalty?
I thought at that time, for me personally, I could draw a line under it at that point, you know, and move on, which wasn't ever going to happen, of course. But for me personally, I thought, right, that was a life. The Queen's life was one of great service, and now the whole thing could be over, you know. But as I say, that wasn't going to happen.
That wasn't how it turned out, for sure. No. I wonder if you can give me a section. We probably won't be able to get all of it, but I love, there are quite, within the collection, Karen, there are little sections of prose poems, there are poems themselves, there are prose sections right throughout it. A Sunlit Weir is an interesting little piece. You might give us the essence of it and maybe read a section of it for us.
It's only a minute long. Perhaps I can read it all. It's just watching these kids splashing around on a summer's day. Shall I read it?
Yes, please.
A Sunlit Weir. A gang of 10 or 11-year-olds at its weedy lip, daring each other to leap. All yells and scroggy limbs, and then the splash, the cheer and gasp, air punches from the post-industrial water below. One after another, they jump. Save for one lad who keeps edging to the brink, then stepping back. Dares forward, only to retreat. Now he's shivering with dismay, though his mates bawl encouragement from below. But here come two young women, truly women, wearing nothing but tiny fluorescent bikinis. They've emerged from the river on the far bank, clambered up among the summer trees. Now they're stepping tall and easily across the weir toward the youngster, sunshine gilding their bellies and thighs. So the goddesses intervene. They take up position behind the lad, against the flow of the river out of unknown hills. Do you think he'll remember this triumph 10 or 30 years hence, when some new challenge is thrown at him? Unmanned in middle age, in his dismay, he'll suddenly recall the cool, steadying hands on his skinny shoulders, the fall of hair, the female voice speaking directly into his left lung.
There we go. A sunlit weir from Kathleen Jemmy. And yes, indeed, it did all fit in. I'm so delighted that we got all of it in there, Kathleen. There is something wonderful about your observation there. And it sounds as if you are almost like painting in the open air, that you were looking at this as you wrote it. How did it happen?
Just that. I was just walking down the river and I could hear all this splashing and carrying on. And so I stopped to watch these kids jumping off this weir. And I remember doing that myself as a youth, but they were braver than me. And just exactly that, watching this poor lad who didn't quite dare do it until the big girls came and encouraged him.
Yes, a little bit of encouragement was all was all that he needed, in fact. But is it a very different process writing? I'm going to refer to it as a prose poem. I hope that is near to what you think of it as. Is it a very different process writing a prose poem like that from writing a straightforward piece of prose? What is the difference in that process for you?
I think all my prose is nearer the poetry end of the spectrum. I mean, I'm listening all the time to the languages. You know, I'm listening to the vowel sounds and the way the lines fall and all the techniques that go into writing quote proper poems. I'm also paying attention to in these wee bits of prose.
Yes, so, there is a nature. Yeah. The language has a poetic nature to it. It isn't quite the language of prose, if I may say.
That's the interesting bit, yeah, you know, listening to the language. Yeah,
of course it is. That's why you're a poet and not a prose writer, I guess, you would tell me. One final question I wanted to ask you about the collection itself. It has these wonderful illustrations throughout it from Mike Swanborn. Just tell me why you wanted that in the collection and what you think it gives to it.
Aren't they wonderful? Mick is a Dutch woman who lives in the Isle of Mull in Scotland here. And I think her really fine line drawings, they slow the pace of the book.
Yeah.
You know, and give pause in between. You know, there's maybe half a dozen, maybe 10 throughout it. And that they break it down and slow the process of reading and bring this lovely visual aspect to it as well. Yes. And so you can't gallop through the book.
No, we have to savour the language that you've bothered to choose in those prose pieces. Kathleen, thanks so much for being with us this evening.
Sure. My pleasure. Thank you.
Kathleen Jemmy there, former National Poet of Scotland, talking to us about her new collection, Cairn. Mickey Swanborn, I beg your pardon, was the illustrator of the book, and the book is published by Sort of Books, and that is our lot for this Monday evening. Barbara Brose Sanwo was the researcher. Ollie Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator. Mark McGrath was on sound this evening, and tonight's programme was produced by Reg Luby. Back with you tomorrow night, 7 o'clock here on RTE Radio 1, and Faith O'Brien On is next after the news.